Hello, Dr. Carl.
Good morning, Dr. Zan.
Very wonderful to see you. And of course, our hour is all about the listeners' questions. So we'd love to hear your questions. 1-300-055-36. A couple of people texting in saying the lines are busy. It's because Dr. Carl is so mad popular. Keep trying. The lines do open up as we get through your questions and calls. And we're going to get through as many as we can today. So let's just dive straight in and go to Sale. Emma's on the line. Hey, Emma.
Hi.
What's your question?
Basically, cats. Why are they face invaders?
Face invaders.
Well, cats are highly intelligent and they know which side their bread is buttered on. In other words, they know how to live. They've conditioned humans to feed them and give back nothing in return. Now, they can either generate heat by their own internal body metabolism, but if they can get a free radiator nearby, they'll go for it. And you're lying in bed and you're unconscious. Hey, here's a nice big lump of heat. Oh, the bed clothes, they're insulators. There's not much heat coming through them. But the face, that's naked flesh and it's generating lots of heat. I'll just sit on their face. I don't care if they can't breathe or if they wake up in a panic. At least I'll be comfortable. So it's sort of like a selfishy,
Selfishness of cats reigns supreme once again.
Yep.
I kind of suspected that. So basically don't breathe.
They don't want you to breathe. Well, they don't care. They do want you to stay alive so that you can keep on generating heat.
For their benefits. Yeah. There you go. Thanks so much for the call, Emma.
Thank you.
Let's go to the sunny coast. Chad's on the line. Hey, Chad.
Hey, Zen. Dr. Carl, how are you?
Good morning. Very well. What's your question?
I have a question about bubbles and coloured water. I have a four-year-old son and he wants a coloured bath. So we colour the bath with food colouring, any colour of the rainbow, and then he may want bubble bath. So we add bubble bath to it and the bubbles are white. Why don't they take on the colour of the water?
Good question.
Now, first thing, you and your son both sound as though you have a lovely sense of curiosity, so I'd recommend that you go to the ABC site, which has Ruben Meerman, the surfing scientist, and he's got all sorts of experiments illustrated by videos or PDFs or Word documents that you can do at home with common household materials like pepper and salt and detergent.
Okay, cool.
Secondly, the answer to your question. If you pour the darkest beer that you can think of, the bubbles are white. With colas, the bubbles are white. Now, think about walking through the middle of a big city and it's really bright sunlight in the middle of the day and there are offices with glass windows at street level.
Yes.
And you look there and it's brighter out where you are, but it's darker inside the surface. So all you see is a reflection of yourself. It's dark inside the building, bright outside.
Yep.
Now, at night, you then go out, and now it's brighter inside the building.
So you
can see in through the glass. It acts like a mirror for them. And when they look out, all they see is reflections of themselves. In the same way, the bubble is made of water with a little bit of dye. It stops some of the light. So therefore, on the inside of the bubble, it's darker. Just like the office building in daylight. And therefore, the outside acts like a mirror. And that's why no matter what the colour of the liquid that makes the bubble itself is whitish. Reflecting the house lights, which normally are white in colour.
So it's reflecting the lights within the bathroom itself.
So what you can do is try having coloured lights in the bathroom. There's lots of experiments you can have.
Next level.
Next level. Cool. Take it
next
up.
Level bathroom party.
A four-year-old will love that.
That's a great question. Thanks for the call, Chad.
Thank you, Dr. Chad. And what a good daddy you are helping out your little boy.
I know. I'm just wondering about the food dye, though. Does that mean that his son is coming out like coloured purple or red or blue or whatever?
Well,
I know it's white, you know, you can wash it out, but it'd be pretty funny.
Well, that would be interesting. I am blue, father. For why am I covered with woad?
Let's go to Melbourne CBD where Jerry is on the line with a question waiting. Hey, Jerry.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's your question?
So I had a question about infinite density. A black hole is a singularity. That's a point of infinite density. And the Big Bang started with a singularity, a point of infinite density. What's the difference between those two singularities?
Ah, huge. So the following objects have no size. A black hole, an electron, a quark, and what was there before the Big Bang? And in each case, we use the word singularity, which, if you ask the clever people in physics, means, hey, man, the laws of physics don't apply. And there are different laws of physics that don't apply, and there will be new laws that we will discover in the future. And it may well be that similar laws exist for the quark and the black hole or any two of the four that I mentioned. But at the moment, we're in the stage of all we can say is the laws of physics, as we have them today, do not apply. Therefore, we'll call it a singularity. And we use the same word singularity for the size of the electron and the universe, but almost certainly the physics was different. But we don't know for sure.
It hurts my head sometimes.
go try quantum. Marcus Chown, Chown, is the guy to read.
Yeah, he makes everything seem a lot less head-hurty, lack of a better term. He's written some great books. He's actually been on here on the show as well. Thanks for the call, Jerry.
Thank you, Dr. Jerry.
Let's head to Tassie. Joel's on the line. Hey, Joel.
Hi, how are you going?
Good, thanks. What's your question?
I've got a question about rising sea levels and ships. So I've got a bit of a theory that, there's tens of thousands of very, very large ships on our oceans these days, and there's always more being built, and they're always getting bigger. Some of the largest ships can displace 100,000 tonnes of
250,000, and right now there is a ship being built which is 600,000 tonnes.
Whoa.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That's a lot of water that's being displaced.
Yes.
And my question is, do you think that could be a major contributor to rising sea levels?
With regard to rising sea levels, it varies with time. It's complicated. But the three main factors are, number one, water that used to be on land as ice, such as Antarctica, Greenland glaciers, that has melted and has been redistributed into the oceans, number one. Number two, the oceans are getting warmer, thermal expansion. Number three, water that was on land and by human activity, you know, mining the aquifers, etc., has been distributed into the oceans. So roughly third, third, third for their contribution to ocean level rise. I did a story on the ships, and I can't remember the exact figure. I think it's between 0.1 millimetre and 1 millimetre. If somebody could tweet that into Dr. Carl, DOCTORKARL, I can give you the answer. And then finally, it gets more complicated again. A few years ago, there were massive floods in Brisbane. That water was coming out of the Indian Ocean. So it rose out of the Indian Ocean and came all the way across Australia and then land on Brisbane, terrible floods, messy, messy. So a few years ago, we had the situation where worldwide, the ocean levels were rising, but at that time that the floods were happening, the ocean levels in the Indian Ocean, thanks to their equivalent of an El Nino, were dropping because so much was rising in evaporation. And sure, it will equilibrate, but not in a second. It takes years for the water to flow around, so it's a complicated issue. If somebody could give me the exact figure, I worked it out and I've forgotten the exact number, but it's of the order 10th to 1 millimetre.
There's a lot of things going on. Thanks for the question, Joel. 1-300-055-36 is the number. We'd love to hear your questions. And we've got one now from a fella who is calling in from Berlin. Hello, William.
Hello, Zan. How are you?
Very well. You're an Irishman, but you're calling in from Berlin at the moment. How do you listen to the Dr. Carl Science Hour?
On the podcast, of course.
Excellent. Well, we're very excited that you're part of the podcast this morning. What's your question?
I'm wondering about carbon offsets, because I've seen things, and I'll tweet one of them to you now, but they offer to plant so many trees to offset your carbon that you burn when you fly or drive your SUV. But I'm wondering how valid is that, because we're digging carbon out of the ground, out of the geology, and it's going into some of it into the atmosphere, some of it is into the biology. But trees grow and they die and then they decay. If you don't put the trees, if you don't kind of cut down the tree trunks and put them in mine shafts underground, that carbon is going to stay in the biosphere. And something would have been growing in that place anyway. So is that valid?
You've done a wonderful, wonderful summary. A tree, on average, will pull out 1 kilogram of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere each day, and we are putting billions of tons into the atmosphere. So we do not have the surface area on land to offset what we're doing. And when we plant the trees, it's not just simply plant the tree and walk out the door. You've then got to make sure that the tree trunk is in buried in the ground, and then another tree grows in that area, and so we lock the carbon away. Your reservations are entirely valid, but it is a step in the right direction. The main step is simply to get our energy without burning carbon, which in Germany you'd be very aware of.
Mm-hmm. So are all of these carbon offset schemes that you can buy, are they a scam?
They're a small step in the right direction, but the big step is simply to stop burning carbon to make energy. But they, it's a soft thing. It doesn't have a huge effect, but it's worthwhile doing. But we should do that as well as everything else. But the main thing is to stop burning carbon. But you did right.
Thanks so much for the call, William.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See you later. Oh. And a reminder that you can listen to Dr. Carl on the podcast live as well at triplej.net.au. But, yeah, the podcast is available every Thursday afternoon. We put it up and there's so many listeners from around the world who join in on the conversation.
It is amazing. My weirdest memory of Berlin is we were there on New Year's Eve and fireworks are legal. And people started throwing fireworks around the place. And about an hour before sunset, there began this almost constant wail of sirens of ambulances taking people to hospitals with injuries from the fireworks.
Ouch. Let's go to Alice Springs. From Berlin to Alice, we're crossing all over the world today, and Hamish is on the line. Hey, Hamish.
How you going?
Good, thanks. What's your question?
Well, you constantly get to see photos of the dark side of planet Earth, and there's all the, you can always sort of see this where the cities are by the amount of light coming off them. And I was wondering, with now we already know where all, a lot of these planets are nearby us, instead of scanning for radio waves just across the whole sky, would there be technology that we could use or that we could develop to actually focus in on these planets and determine whether there's artificial light coming from the dark side of that planet that's facing us?
Yes, the technology is being built now. It's called the James Webb Telescope. It's a huge telescope that'll be a space telescope with a mirror much, much, much bigger than the 1 meter or so mirror that we had with the Hubble. I think it's about 10 or so meters across. It's huge. Now, imagine that you're doing what the Kepler Space Telescope did. The Kepler Space Telescope, in an orbit trailing behind the Earth, was staring at one section of the Milky Way where there are about 2 million stars, and it specifically chose, with its unblinking gaze, about 150,000 stars, and it monitored those stars all the time. And it would find that there'd be a sudden, you know, go bright, 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 and a dip over 10 hours as, it turned out, a planet went across the front of that star.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, a month, a week, a year later, the same thing. And if it happened a couple of times, you could say, that's definitely a planet. But with the James Webb, all we could pick with the little Kepler telescope was the fact that there was a dip in the light. But with the James Webb telescope, we might, I don't know, be able to look at the amount of light, and then as the planet rotates, it'll show parts of itself that have more light and less light coming from the dark side, and we might be able to pick that up. That is,
okay.
Wow, that's a very good idea. I'll have to read up more on a James Webb to see if that's part of their goal. That's a brilliant idea. Have you thought of becoming an astronomer?
Not yet.
It's never too late to have a
life
happy
is short,
childhood.
Hamish. Thanks for the call.
Thank you very much.
See you later. Let's go to the sunny coast where Nathan's on the line. Hey, Nathan.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, thanks. Ooh. Can you just turn your radio down for us in the background?
Yes, I can, darling.
Thank you. Yeah. Darling.
Darling.
Interesting.
Oh, my God.
What's your question, Nathan?
My question, okay, I was a smoker for about 20-odd years. I gave up about 5 years ago. When I hold my breath and try to push air out, then open my mouth, basically I'm still getting smoke coming out of my lungs.
Is this from other people telling you that they can smell cigarette smoke?
No.
Is it just you?
I can actually see it.
Oh, so you can see something in the air, but you don't. Your eyes do not do spectrographic analysis, so you can't tell whether it's water vapor or tobacco. Can you smell it?
No, I can't smell. I just assumed that it was smoke because I've been doing it for years, even when I was smoking.
Oh. Now, Nathan, what did they teach you in kindergarten? Assume makes an ass of you and me. Okay, now look, do an experiment for me. Blow on the palm of your hand with your open mouth, okay, and tell me the temperature.
Very warm.
Okay, now with the same mouth onto the same palm of the hand, make a tiny, tiny little hole and blow onto the same palm of hand.
Very cool.
Right. It could well be that you're generating enough pressure and the outside air is humid enough that you can be generating temporarily a small number of water droplets. What you need is a very close and caring and forgiving friend to smell your breath every time you breathe out under these circumstances and tell you whether they're smelling cigarette smoke or not.
Do the experiment, come back to us, Nathan.
Okay. And there may be well be other chemicals. There could be another pathology going on. I don't know. Get your friend to check you. Get back to us.
Yeah, let us know, Nathan. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
See you later. Let's go to Kilmore. Sean's on the line. Hey, Sean.
Sean.
Hey, doctors, how's it going?
Good. Good, you doctor. Work night shift.
I do. I'm a baker. I know a lot of other bakers as well. We work like 12 till 8, 9 in the morning.
And I just want to thank you for your contribution to the world, because bread is the greatest.
And when I was a taxi driver, I used to love the bakers because I'd be taking them to work between 12 midnight and 2 in the morning. I felt so sorry for the poor buggers having a permanent vampire nightlife.
So what's your experience, Sean?
Great. Sorry, what was that?
What's your experience? What's your question?
So my question is, I have in the past few years, and I've known a few other people to fly out of the country, like to America, Indonesia, or places like that. And none of us have ever experienced jet lag. I was just wondering if it's something to do with the hours that we work, maybe we've conditioned our bodies.
Oh, wow. Hang on. Yeah. So you and other people who work this odd night shifty thing tend not to experience jet lag. So is this to the USA, which is 14 hours to LA, or to Europe, which is about 22 hours?
Well, so my boss, actually, a couple months ago, he went to Las Vegas, and he said that was about a 23-hour flight, and he got off the plane, and he was completely fine, whereas his wife was completely buggered.
Wow.
And another mate went to Texas, and he said the same thing, whereas everyone else on the flight was just completely right.
Probably need a very big sample size, more than three, wouldn't you, Dr. Carl,
yeah,
of bakers?
But it's interesting, though, isn't it? It's very interesting because you get these hints and then you have to follow it up with a proper study.
Of whether you can actually program or condition your body to, be, not out of whack.
Wow, look. The answer would probably have been done by the sleep scientist. So if somebody can check up for us on Google Scholar, circadian rhythms, jet lag, and I guess night shift workers, and see if it turns out that night shift workers are less likely to suffer jet lag.
Got a couple of texts coming through. Thanks so much for the call, Sean.
Yeah, that's deep.
No worries. Deep.
From someone who's a paramedic, works constantly at night and can guarantee they definitely get jet lag. Thank you, Matt. But someone else texting in, I'm a baker and I've never had any trouble with jet lag. And another person just texting in, they are always in a state of jet lag, in bakers.
Wow.
Who knows? It could be an individual thing. I'd love to know from anyone who works shift work and has experienced the same thing, that you don't get jet lag after long flights. Let's go to Canberra now. Tarek's on the line. Hey, Tarek.
Hello, doctors. How are you doing?
Very well. What's your question?
Mine's about when you look into a mirror, the image reverses. So if you've got like a watch on your left hand, then the mirror image has it on its right hand. So if the image inverses because it's a mirror reflection, and left and right swap around, how come top and bottom don't swap around?
This causes problems every time this question is raised in the back pages of The New Scientist in the section called The Last Word. The best way to appreciate it is to go to Wikipedia and look up what's called a ray diagram. And when you do, you'll realize that when you're looking into a mirror, you're effectively getting rid of the mirror and putting yourself the same distance on the other side of the glass. And then when you're looking, you're seeing the left-right thing makes sense and the up-down thing also makes sense, because up is up and down is down. And you're seeing on the right what to that person is their left. Go to the ray diagram, look it up there. It is slightly confusing. I haven't explained it well. I know I haven't explained it well. I'm bowing out before I get into more trouble.
Okay.
It's a deep question. Back pages of The New Scientist are filled with people with academics from visual psychology and experimental optical illusions who argue about this, so the answer I gave is very shallow and probably wrong.
He's given you homework, Tarek. Go forth.
Sorry,
thanks for the call. Dr. Carl is with us on this Thursday morning. Zanro here with you as well. 1-300-055-36 is the number for your questions. You got an answer for us, Carl?
The web has. For Tarek and mirrors, here's a direct quote. There's a very good video on YouTube with Richard Feynman, F-E-Y-N-M-A-N, explaining mirrors. Tonight I'll be watching it, and I hope you do too.
Thank you for that person messaging in
to
help out Tarek. It really is a community of brains and knowledge that we have here, and we thank you for taking part. Let's head now to Danielle calling in from Ebenezer. Hey, Danielle.
Hi, how are you going?
Good, thanks. What's your question?
A little bit of background. So we had a plant that was potted upstairs, and
it had died. So I depotted it, just ripped it out of the pot and put it in the backyard. And about 2 weeks later, my partner came home and the plant was smouldering. And when he went down and he opened it up, it caught a light. I'm wondering what causes that, and I've never heard of anything like that, and I saw it with my own eyes, and I can't explain it.
And so when you exposed it to the sunlight, then you started to get this... Well, actually, that's very good. You see, it turns out that a compost pile puts out more energy weight for weight and volume for volume than the sun, which is powered by thermonuclear hydrogen bomb reactions. So the reason that the sun puts out so much energy is that the sun is very lazy. But there is a lot of power coming out of a compost pile. And when you exposed it to the air, you allowed oxygen to get in there, and then you were able to get other reactions. There were firstly anaerobic, then aerobic reactions. The bottom line is that there is enough power in there to be hotter than the sun, to put out more power than the sun, and you just activated. You were lucky.
Wow.
Thanks so much for the call, Danielle.
Thank you. Now, I'm trying to find... here it is. A kilogram of veggies and grass clippings can generate 14 watts as it turns into organic humus. So that's kilogram for kilogram, 70,000 times more power than the sun.
Whoa. Let's go to St Kilda, where Aaron's on the line. Hey, Aaron.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks. What's your roommate been up to?
Yeah, so my roommate, every single time he seems to get drunk, like really drunk, he'll sleepwalk. And not only will he sleepwalk, but he'll pee in all different places. So
that's unfortunate.
The bin or the corner of the room or just anywhere, but it's only when he drinks.
Ah, the technical term is frontal, like the adjective of front. Frontal, it's an odd adjective. You don't talk about backal, but nevertheless there's the word frontal. Disinhibition. So the frontal lobes of your brain inhibit you from strangling the cat when you have boiled some water for too long or burnt the stove, or it keeps you in line. It makes you a better member of society. And when you drink alcohol, those inhibitions are removed to some degree, so-called disinhibition. So your friend has got a tendency to sleepwalk anyway, which is not dangerous unless they walk off a building or something, and he's also being disinhibited. The solution, I'm sorry, is blindingly obvious.
Don't drink.
That's it. I'm sorry.
Don't drink in excess.
It's just unavoidable. So he can't, he's just going to have to risk it every time he gets that drunk that he's going to be doing it.
Or again, as Dr. Carl says, don't get that drunk.
Yeah, or just for him, not for everybody else. So, for example, I have a friend who suffers from phenylketonuria, and if they have phenylalanine, it'll damage their brain and reduce their IQ. And so this happens to 1 in 15,000 people in our society, and these people who know that they have phenylketonuria know that they don't drink the diet colder drinks which have phenylalanine. In the case of your friend, he's got something in his brain, and it's very simple, just don't drink that much.
Thanks so much for the call, Aaron.
No worries.
See you later. Let's go to Q, where Jane's on the line. Hi, Jane.
Good morning.
Good morning. What's your question?
Look, I watched that video with a newborn baby that gets fitted with the hearing aid and hears the mother's voice for the first time.
Yeah.
And it got me to thinking, well, if they can't hear, do they hear when they're in utero? And if so, does that mean the sort of, when people talk to the baby and sing, and would they be hearing any of that, and how that affects the bonding?
Well,
if that was the case,
yeah, there's different causes of hearing. The hearing chain is complicated, going from having an eardrum, which moves back and forth a tiny distance equal to the diameter of a hydrogen atom when you're listening to a very quiet sound, to the little bones moving, to the oval window pushing in and out, and correspondingly the round window pushing out and in, to pressure waves going in the cochlea, to hair cells bending, and as they bend, giving off electricity, to electricity then travelling up the acoustic nerve and then going into the brain. And so if, for example, the problem was purely that the kid in utero didn't have an eardrum, then in that case, they would still feel vibrations coming through their body. So, for example, Beethoven was so deaf from damage to his cochlea that, or to the other part, that he would hold a pencil in his teeth and bang the piano so loudly that he could then pick up the vibrations through the pencil in his teeth, but he would break pianos. But if we're talking about the case where it's nerve damage, basically, they would be like a newborn baby trying to make sense of these funny things called sounds and then realizing that the sounds came at you when somebody opened their mouth or a tree fell and then gradually turning it into, good morning, darling, would you like some milk or orange juice? So they'd go through the same learning process that a newborn baby would go through at day one, but they do it from the date of the implant.
Right.
Thanks for the call, Jane.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I think Jane was just trying to get her head around it all.
Yeah.
It's like an often response, isn't it? You know, after you give an answer, people just kind of like, okay.
Yeah, but often when I'm listening to science podcasts, I have to play them back five or six times. And when it gets to four or five times, I pull over at the side of the road and I sometimes have to go to seven times to understand what they're saying.
You need to let it sink in.
Oh,
that's why the podcast is
such a
gift.
At the moment, I'm trying to do a story on bitcoins and the blockchain technology. And I almost understand it after having spent Friday nights, Saturday and Sunday, and then I had a talk. I studied on Monday, and then somebody came down and gave me a tutorial for 1.5 hours. And I'm about 20 hours into explaining a blockchain, and I still don't fully understand it. And then once I fully understand it, which is probably another 5 hours, I'm then going to have to try to work out how to explain it to a kid.
I'm looking forward to finding out your explanation about Bitcoin. Let's go to Perth now. Max is on the phone. Hey, Max.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
I was Dr. Zan.
Hi.
Dr. Max.
What's your question, Max?
I was wondering, when there's a full moon and there's no clouds, sometimes there's still like a bright ring like surrounding the moon. I was wondering, what is it?
Well, what you have as the cause, the so-called classical high altitude hexagonal ice crystals. And they're there or not, depending on when the moon is full or not. But when the moon is full, there's more of the surface of the moon reflecting light. So then the ring is more visible. And you're looking at the ring having a diameter around the moon of about 22 degrees, but sometimes it can be smaller. So look up this in Wikipedia and you'll see wonderful pictures as well as ray diagrams explaining how it happens. And if you take a photo on time-lapse for a few seconds with your camera, you can see that there's colour there. You can't always see it with the naked eye. You can get a hint that there's a bit of red, but often with a camera on a 1 or 3 second photo, you can actually see the full colours of the rainbow. High altitude ice crystals.
Hey, thanks for the call, Max. Let's go to Melbourne where Katie's on the line. Hey, Katie.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
When I was eating my breakfast this morning, I'm looking over and I see my microwave and it has a digital time shown just on the front of it. And when I'm eating, I notice that the digital time sort of moves and shakes as I eat, but the rest of what I see in the kitchen doesn't. So it's just that digital time that shakes as I eat. So I was just wondering what causes that.
Right. Were you eating something hard and gritty like carrots or very hard muesli or something soft and squishy like a mango?
Crunchy like cornflakes.
Exactly. Now, you can do the same thing with an electric toothbrush or a carrot if you don't particularly love electric toothbrushes, but I do. And what happens is that the image on the light display of the microwave is not there 100% of the time. The sun is there 100% of the time. It's always there shining, and in each second it's there for the full second. But with the LED display or the liquid crystal display, to save electricity, they switch it on and off hundreds of times a second.
Ah.
So it might be on for one-third of the time and off for two-thirds, but because it's switching on and off so fast, so quickly, it's like a movie, on, off, on, off. So when you're the movie, you're seeing the image half the time, and the other half of the time there's blackness, but providing the image has come to you faster than about 20 or so times a second, it looks like reality. And so the image can change. You can shift from here to there across the field of view. This is the bit that worries me. Is it a clock hand that's rotating, or is it numbers just like 1, 2, 3, 4?
Yeah, it's just numbers.
I don't fully understand that bit. But I'll have to think about that. Maybe somebody can give us an answer and try the experiment with a carrot. Carrots do really good vibrations through your skull.
That's very cool. They shift
the eyeball around and it focuses on different parts. Oh, that's it. That's it. I've got it. So you're biting something really crunchy like a carrot, right? And it puts a shockwave through your skull and your eyeball goes up, and down. And if the image happens to be shown to your eyeball when it's up or when it's down, you'll get that flickering point of view. When it's happening in reality, I'm still haven't fully got it. There's a thing called a saccade, S-A-C-C-A-D-E for delta. If you look it up on Wikipedia, you spend 7 years of your life blind because your eyes are flicking from one thing to another. And when they flick from one object to another, you see nothing. Your vision switches off. And I think that's tied in with it as well. I have to think more deeply about this. With a TV, it's easy, but with a clock on a microwave, still thinking.
I love it. You just opened up a whole can of worms in a great way. Thanks for the call, Katie. Great question. Right now we're talking with Dr. Carl and doing Science Talk Back. 1-300-055-36 is the number if you've got a question for us. As David does, calling in from Epping today. Hey, David.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good. Thanks. What's your question?
So my question today is ADD, attention deficit disorder, a modern diagnosis, or is it an evolutionary trait?
A bit of both, but it seems to have been more carefully diagnosed now that we've become aware of it. And I remember talking with Norman Swan when he first went out with a camera crew to talk to some parents and kids who had it. And he said before he went out, he didn't really believe that it existed from what he'd been seeing as a doctor in a kids' hospital. But these kids were just bouncing around the house as though they'd had 20 cups of coffee, couldn't concentrate on anything at all, would jump up and down, rip the place apart. There are advantages for it because you have people who are really tuned to their environment and are good guards for the tribe of nomads, as we were, for the vast majority of our evolutionary history going back 200,000 years as Homo sapiens. And they'd be really good people to have, ready to jump on anything, but not be able to do long-term concentration.
If you feel like it's a bit of both, though, does that suggest that it's gone undiagnosed in previous generations?
Precisely.
Right.
It was just put down to them being evil, wicked, possessed by the devil or a vampire.
You think it's increasing in modern times?
Don't know, because we need to follow it through with time. It could be that there are modern factors causing it to increase. We do know, for example, that things in our brains are changing, such as the brain. Look up my story on the Flynn effect, F-L-Y-N-N effect, where the IQ is going up around the world by 9 IQ points every generation.
So smart.
Yeah, but your kids will be smarter than you. Mine are smarter than me. Which is good because they can fix up the problems better. But the thing is that there are some factors happening, we think, as a result of modern society. Could ADD be one of them? Haven't got enough data yet to tell.
Thanks so much for the call, David. Good question.
Thank you.
And I'm happy in the knowledge that we're getting smarter. That makes me feel good about the future ahead. Chris is calling in from New South Wales. Hey, Chris.
Hi, how are you going? Welcome.
Good. What's your question?
Getting levels for like houses, you can use like a piece of clear hose with water in it.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, like, obviously you're getting the water's just working out its level from gravity of the earth, yeah?
Mm-hmm, yep.
So does the water just follow the curvature? Like if you had like a really long one that was like 100 metres, would it just follow the curvature of the earth as well?
Yes. You couldn't quite see it easily over 100 metres. I've just done the S equals UT plus half AT squared, and I think that in 5 kilometres, the Earth curves 5 metres.
Okay.
So it's one in a thousand.
But over, say, a 25-metre long house, would you have, like, it'd be obviously only very small, but there'd be a slight curve in it, wouldn't be perfectly level?
25 metres, it might be 25 millimetres. Maybe that one in a thousand is wrong, but over 25 metres, it couldn't curve 25 millimetres. That's a whole inch. I must be wrong. There is a definite curvature. I haven't worked it out, but there would be one, but I must be wrong. It must be less than one in a thousand.
Okay.
Thanks for the call, Chris.
No worries. Thank you.
Let's go to the Goldie where Cassie's on the line. Hey, Cassie.
Hello. How are you?
Good, thanks. What's your question?
My question is regarding how or what determines a way of person's absorbing information. So whether it's visual or auditory or actually doing the task, and if you can retrain your brain to learn in a different way, like if you are a uni student and you're used to going to classes and then you change to an online student, so obviously your method of absorbing information would change, or you know what I mean?
There has been a big move recently and I think perhaps too far, for saying that some people are visual learners and other people are acoustic learners and other people are hands-on learners. And I think there is some degree of truth in that, but not as much as is pushed. The most common factor I can find with regard to learning new stuff is the importance of frequent retesting.
Okay.
Over and over, it comes back that if you test yourself,
yeah,
often you will lock that knowledge in. There are people who can remember every day of their lives.
Yeah.
And you can say, what happened on the 20th of January 1999? And I can say, oh, it was a Wednesday and, oh, there was a big rainstorm. Oh, and I was coming home from work. Oh, and there was a tree that got knocked over by the storm on the line. And you check it up and it was right. And their memories are the same as ours for the first month. Whereas ours begin to fade away, theirs don't. Yeah. So in the learning literature, if you get past the, you know, buy my course and do it acoustically, you'll find that there are certain time intervals. And there was an article about The New Scientist, and I think 6 weeks comes up and 3 weeks as well, where the frequent retesting locks it in. That's more important than
what if you're not good at tests?
Some people are not,
yeah.
and they know the stuff, but they're just lousy. In fact, one of my bosses at the kids' hospital was the best kids' doctor I ever had, and everybody respected him and went to him for opinions, kept on failing exams, just didn't like the stress of it. That's hard.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? Different people learn in different ways, it's true. Yeah. So, but we all kind of subscribe to a very conservative way of teaching and learning.
Yeah. In that case, try and find a grandfather clause that sneaks you in. So the frequent testing is the most important thing. The other thing is that before you have a lecture, study the material before the lecture rather than after, and that way the lecture is just revision. So you're still doing the same amount of work. Yeah. You're just shifting it forward by 24 hours, and my kids did that, and it lifted their marks up to distinction level.
And I was just wondering, would it determine, what hand you wrote with either, like if you were ambidextrous or left-handed or...
Very soft. That's a very soft effect. The main factor is the frequent retesting.
Hey, thanks for the call, Cassie. Okay. Good discussion. Jake texting in Sydney as well, saying, I was in the military and the amount of retesting and revision has been super effective.
Yes.
I think that like anything, if you're talking about it continuously, like I know nothing about fractions, but I can tell you lots of useless music trivia. It's because I use it every day and that's kind of key to solidifying that knowledge. Hopefully you solidified a bit of knowledge yourself. Dr. Carl has been with us over the last hour and you can catch up on that podcast and solidify it even more later on this afternoon. We'll see you next week, Carl.
Peachy keen.